This is chapter 4, Awareness. This is a really fun chapter because now we get both Santideva's clear, fabulous instructions as well as his pep talk to himself, and his drama, his inner drama queen emerges as he gives instructions to himself. So there are these commercials. I was at Thanksgiving with my sister, and there are these commercials with James Earl Jones reading people's tweets. And they're hysterical because they don't make sense, but you hear this Shakespearean actor with his booming voice. So this whole chapter needs to be read as James Earl Jones. So again, we think of how to understand even the translation of the sense of what awareness is and what mindfulness is. The next two chapters, this one and the next one, are on developing mindfulness. And the first is just awareness. The first aspect of that is awareness of what's going on. And so it can be translated as conscientiousness, heedfulness, carefulness, vigilance, and alertness. And what we're alert to is the pledge that we have just made in the previous chapter to change our focus from ourselves to benefiting others. One of the translations of bodhicitta, we've been talking about bodhicitta all along, is a fearless heart, the confidence of being able to generate a pure heart and compassion towards others. So there's a fearless heart, which is our innate bodhicitta, and then our growing confidence that we have the capacity to uncover our fearless heart. So we're using the alertness now to examine our minds from moment to moment and to actually see how we are making choices and decisions from moment to moment. And so that is the quality of alertness that is being taught. As we have done with the earlier chapters, we've taken the bodhicitta prayer that you're all familiar with that we have on our dedication page. Bodhicitta, excellent and precious mind, where it is unborn, may it arise. So the first three chapters had to do with where it is unborn, may it arise. And now, where it is born, may it not decline. So we've given rise to this aspiration. We've convinced ourselves that it is the most precious quality of any heart, and we have it innately in our own hearts. And how do we ensure that our little seed that's sprouting continues to grow and doesn't decline? And it has to do with being aware, being self-reflective, seeing what kinds of thoughts are passing through our mind. In terms of our developing understanding of training, it's in the category of discipline. So there's a sense of now entering the training and starting to understand discipline. It seems like anytime we even say the word discipline, people start to shake in their boots a little bit. As though there's something wrong with it. But discipline is mindfulness of body, speech, and mind, and mindfulness of the consequences of body, speech, and mind. We want a certain level of discipline to be. We're saying to ourselves, now we're going to pay attention. You know, all these years we have had an inkling that this aspiration is possible. Sometimes we haven't kept it in our attention as much as we wish that we had, and now we're going to really give ourselves the training to keep it in our mind moment to moment. I want to intersperse today's talk with quotes from Nelson Mandela. So the first quote, there's no passion to be found playing small and settling for a life that is less than the one you're capable of living. So we see our great teachers manifesting as bodhisattvas and Buddhas. We see Nelson Mandela manifesting as a bodhisattva because he was able to train his mind. He sat painfully moment to moment training his mind to love. He said over and over again, hate is taught and therefore love can be taught. You know, so we will be remembering him and his great example for the world as we go through this chapter. So the particularly as we're thinking about this, one of the first qualities is to recognize that we do a lot of meditation on the cushion and we might read and study, but then we want to look at the times when we're off the cushion, when we're tired, when we're confused, when we're fearful. And in that moment, because our alertness is present, to teach ourselves the Dharma in those moments. So when we're thinking of Nelson Mandela in prison, if he hadn't been able to teach himself to love, he would have gone crazy. You know, to be in prison with a mind in turmoil for 27 years would make you crazy. So his choice was to teach himself to love. And we know that from the great examples of the Tibetans and other great examples. So following that example, the first verse, the children of the conqueror who thus have firmly grasped bodhicitta should never turn away from it, but always strive to keep its disciplines. So when we take the bodhisattva vow, we become a child of the Buddha. And in our prayer books, we have that. The bodhisattva vow, and those people who are studying Nundro have the bodhisattva vow over and over again. And there's that confidence that when you have pledged to turn your mind towards others, you become a child of the Buddha. So you can think of that also as being a brother or sister to Nelson Mandela. You've made the same pledge that he's made. You are now in his family. You're in Garchen Rinpoche's family. You're in the family of the people who've made that pledge. And once you've been accepted in that family, you don't turn away from it. You strive to keep its disciplines. Seeing that it's absolutely possible for a human being, enter into the training, and the traditional training are the six paramitas. So in previous chapters, we've talked about generosity. Now we're entering into the section on discipline, and the rest of the book will go through each of the perfections, finally getting to wisdom at the end. But it's a extraordinary training. Also, when you take the bodhisattva vow, if we were naturally selfless in this moment, we wouldn't need do's and don'ts. But the Buddha, seeing the continuous mistakes that we make, gives us pretty clear advice. You don't want to steal. Things like that. So there are many books on if you want to keep your bodhisattva vow strong, these are good adages to keep in mind. And so I'm not going to go over the sort of the 18 points of keeping your bodhisattva vow strong. Lots of books like The Jewel Ornament of Liberation has that. But if we want to simplify it in its essence, if we were to simplify it in terms of one sentence, it would be never shutting your heart down to any living being. So that's, you know, the pith of the vow. And then if we were going to then say, well, what is that like? If the occasion to help someone arises, someone, some being, even an insect arises, and you don't offer that help, you would be weakening your vow. Even an enemy, if there a moment to arise helps, if you've made the pledge to benefit all living beings, then that means everybody. That's why in the Drikung we start out with the prayer, even my enemies, may they become enlightened as well. And that's why you see the Tibetans in the path where people walk, moving all the insects out of the pathway, giving them the help, saving their life in that moment. So even an insect, moving it out of the path, or here the little things that bugs that come in our sinks and things. When there's a chance to save beings from harm and one has no thought of doing so, so there you might have the thought and pass it by, and in this case you might have no thought. That's a very shut down heart. Or if you permanently give rise to the feeling, I'm only going to help myself. This Dharma helps me stop feeling so badly, but I'm not going to worry about anyone else. I'm just going to help myself. So this doesn't mean a moment of discouragement. It just means a permanent change to not thinking of others. So those are things to avoid. And when you think about it, when you think of folks that would be the most difficult to help, the most confused, it would be those people who not only have no thought of others but feel justified in having no thought of others. So we think of the atmosphere like the companies that get so caught up in greed that their focus becomes solely their accomplishment and they feel justified in not thinking of others. So human beings can get to that point of confusion, but we see how sad that is. When we see the different choices arising in our mind, knowing that those are the dangers, we look to find, when do you start choosing security over fearlessness? So in your day-to-day life, you're thinking, shall I do this or shall I not do this? When is it, oh, I'm going to go for this in the moment of security? I'm afraid to go through that other door. A tiny bit of fear arises. I'm going to run to security. And that can come up in large and small ways in our life. Again, the Bodhisattva vow is considered, they say it's like a gold pot, in that gold is really malleable, and if it's broken, you can easily repair it because it can be repaired over a very low heat. And so we simply take the vow over and over and over again, each time being more firm in our aspiration and more firm in our resolve to stay in the family, stay with the principles of the family. So then Shantideva says, okay, the times when you need to be really mindful and aware of your bodhicitta, there are five kinds of situations. When it arises, so you nurture it, just like a little seedling, taking care of it. Before you make a commitment, seeing if that commitment is going to be helpful and beneficial. After you make a commitment, again, seeing, was it made too rashly? Is it actually going to be beneficial and helpful? Relating to the cause and effect of karma, so paying attention to the consequences of all your actions, and when we're seduced by our afflictive emotions or seduced by our kleshas or seduced by neurosis or seduced by addiction. There's no actual word that translates for klesha in a way that incorporates all of that. So most of us have some experience with some form of addiction, and then you can look to see how some of your emotions that torture you and cloud your mind are like an addiction, like anger, like jealousy, like greed, those kinds of things. So these are when you have to pay attention, especially pay attention to the bodhicitta. And he has verses that address these situations. So verse 2, whatever was begun without due heed, and all that was not properly conceived, although a promise and a pledge were given, it is right to hesitate, to press on or draw back. This is addressing trying to go too fast too quickly. The Tibetan saying that if a fox tries to leap the distance of a lion, the fox will break its back. So there's a sense, particularly for us, to say, okay, we've taken the vow to benefit all sentient beings. It does seem huge. What are the small steps that will actually change our hearts and the way we think, as opposed to giant steps that we can't accomplish that will cause discouragement? So there's a story about Shariputra, who was one of the great students of the Bodhisattva, and he became tremendously enthusiastic about offering whatever was asked. And a demon came and said, I want your arm. So at that point, his meditation was very strong, and the demon wanted the right arm, so he cut off his right arm and he offered it, but he offered it with his left arm. And then the demon said, well, I can't accept an offering with the left arm because that's the hand that you wouldn't use in polite society in India. And so Shariputta got discouraged with the unreasonableness of people. he was offering too much too soon. And so in this particular example, it said that because he allowed himself to become so discouraged, he achieved the level of enlightenment of an arhat, but not the complete enlightenment because of his momentary loss of the relative aspect of bodhicitta. And then other scholars say, well, of course he achieved enlightenment, he just retook the vow later. But there's a sense in the teaching aspect of it, you know, to really look at your commitments in terms of what you can offer and what you won't immediately shirk back and say, oh, that's too much, I can't, I've got to run away. Very, very sensible advice. And so then, now you hear him giving himself a pep talk. Yet all the Buddhas and their heirs have thought of this. In their great wisdom, I myself have weighed it and pondered it. So why should I now doubt and hesitate? And now he talks about waffling. So it's one thing to examine cautiously what you're going to do that will benefit beings. It's another thing to waffle and go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So then he has looked at Nelson Mandela. So, okay, look at this great being. Look at how he went from espousing violence and his great anger at the situation of his people to a pure and loving heart, able to work with everyone. This man was able to do it. All the great examples of all my teachers, they were all able to do it. So without turning back, without hesitation, I'm going into the training that they've done. And, you know, I've thought about it, I've considered it, I've looked at it, and now I go straight forward, full steam ahead. So one of the things that I was looking at in this particular verse was Annie Pema's wisdom on this, because she advises us to really look at every single kind of pattern that we're creating and how we create habitual patterns. Looking to see every kind of action that you do is creating a thread in your brain, like a connection in your brain. Is this strengthening bodhicitta or weakening it? Is this opening my heart or closing my heart? And just to keep that simple thought in mind to see what kind of patterns are being strengthened with every action moment to moment. You know, just the simple question, is it strengthening the bodhicitta or weakening the bodhicitta? And her insights into patterns and how we build patterns, when you read her, you can see how she worked with her mind. So when we're looking at the different commentaries, and this holds true for any teaching that we're being given, it's really interesting to see what are the gifts and strengths of different teachers and where is the meat of how they achieved their great wisdom. And not sort of be dismayed if you don't get it, if you don't get excited or passionate from one chapter that the teacher has written, then you might find the next chapter is where their brilliance shines. You know, to really look at several different teachers on the same topic. So you start to see, I'm not quite getting this, I don't understand it, this text isn't helping me, maybe the next text will. Do you see what I mean? You want to elicit the passion of the teachers to help understand the text that you're reading and not give up. So, for instance, we're thinking about Kenshin Kuncho Gelsen, and Venerable Dahani was telling us to read The Jewel Ornament every single year. And the early translation by Gunther, I just couldn't understand. But when Kenshin translated, it was like an open door, just a thought about studying. So we're looking at patterns. We're using our awareness to look at patterns and what we're strengthening. Are we going where we wish to go? Now he continues, verse 4, for if I bind myself with promises but fail to carry out my word and deed, then every being will have been betrayed. What destiny would lie in store for me? This chapter, again, is his dramatic pep talks, not meant to engender fear in anyone. Now he's saying, look at, in particular, at the karma we're creating with our actions. When I was explaining how we pour water on the altar and how water was considered an offering that we could give without ever feeling like, oh, it's too much, I can't do it, right? It was an offering that you could make and you could study generosity by feeling you could give as much water every day as you wanted, right? So it was this easy thing to give. The teaching on that was, well, if you were giving something that was more dear, you might regret or hesitate. And that if you were regretting and hesitating generosity, an act of generosity, you would be strengthening poverty mentality, right? So we give water so that we strengthen the generosity mentality, training to give larger, bigger things. So he's saying, okay, if that's true of a small act like offering water and hesitating and strengthening our inner hungry ghost, what is it like to make the bodhisattva vow and then hesitate about that and step back about that? We would be strengthening a pattern of letting all sentient beings down as opposed to moving forward. So the teachings ask us really to look at what can we do moment to moment in our minds to strengthen our pattern, our bodhisattva commitment. Not to be afraid, not to hesitate, to go forward into training, and to look at what we can do, strengthen what we can do. You see, hearing what I mean? So then he looks at that further. Verse 6, how can I expect a happy destiny if from my heart I summon wandering beings to the highest bliss, but then deceive them and let them down? Therefore, I will act devotedly according to the promises I have made. For if I fail thus to apply myself, I'll fall from low to even lower states. So again, it's not to engender fear, like, oh my goodness, what am I personally doing? It's, this is how he's working with his mind. I promise this, I'm in the family, I don't want to let all these beings down, so I will apply myself devotedly. He's looking at the consequences of having the brilliant mind, of having the teachers appear in the world, of having the leisure and endowment to be able to accomplish this and choose ignorance instead, that he'd be letting everyone down, including himself. And he would be strengthening the pattern of ignorance, which would have karmic consequences. Khandro Rinpoche was reading a commentary, and I'm sorry, I don't have the name of the commentary she was reading. There were just a series of quotes. But this quote is very helpful. Even if I, as a meditator, am not able to truly develop the perfection of the paramitas in my actions of body, speech, and mind, I aspire at this moment to at least train my mind stream to be genuinely selfless. And that might begin with making simple offerings of water and seeing the water going out to whoever is thirsty. Then Shantideva is reflecting and reviewing his situation again. We're going to verse 14. The appearances of Buddhas in this world, true faith, and the attainment of the human form, and the aptitude for good, all these are rare. And when will all this come to me again? We have the perfect situation. We have met fabulous teachers. We are not carrying stones on our back building a road every day. Today, indeed, I am hale and hearty, have enough to eat, and am without affliction. And yet this life is fleeting and deceptive. This body is but briefly lent to me. So we have the circumstances, and it's fleeting and brief. And he reminds himself of this in many different ways throughout the chapter. I like to see him as my personal buddy. So like me, a moment of fear arises, and then he reminds himself, we do not know. Our dear friend Kenshin just fell, has a terrible accident. You know, he was hale and hearty one day. The next day, he's clearly struggling with pain. So while we have this moment, to use this moment of now, the successive moments of now, to train our minds, we start with just the intention to bring about mindfulness. We set that intention to notice when we're being mindful and when we're not. So when we look at the basic meditation that we do, the shamatha meditation, we see how setting that intention in our mind is really significant. For 20 minutes, we can sit and say, I want to be mindful, and the thing that I'm going to be mindful about in this instance is my breath, and we can see how immediately our mind is gone, and it goes back many, many times, and we bring it back, right? So one of the many purposes of the calm abiding meditation of shamatha is to learn how to become mindful so that then you can apply the focus moment to moment to moment on the cushion and off the cushion. The second is irreversible confidence, leaving no room for hesitation and doubt. And again, we look to our teachers, we look to the great beings like Nelson Mandela. Yes, it is possible. We have irreversible confidence that it's possible. We have devotion, and we have effort to strive towards the bodhicitta aspiration. So we're pledging to clearly look at what is created by unnecessary ignorance. Just like we're looking at how our minds work in the 20 minutes of the shamatha meditation, now we're pledging to look at our minds all the time. The foundation of taking care of this little seedling in our heart is paying attention moment to moment. Are we strengthening it? As Thich Nhat Hanh likes to say, are we watering that seed? Or are we watering the anger seed or the jealousy seed or the selfish seed? Right? Okay, now we're going into the James Earl Jones section. Here is now the chance for wholesome deeds, but if I fail now to accomplish virtue, what will be my lot? What shall I do when trapped in lower realms, enmeshed in misery? Thus having found reprieve from all these things, if I now fail to train myself in virtue, whatever folly, greater folly, could there be? how more could I betray myself? It's like what folly it would be to betray ourselves. Through all this, I understand, but later waste my time in foolish idleness. Then when my time comes to die, my sorrows will be black indeed. Here he is saying, we have the perfect conditions. What greater craziness would it be to have struggled for lifetimes to have the perfect conditions and then waste them? Again, Nelson Mandela, one of the most difficult things is not to change society, but to change yourself. And again, Nelson Mandela, there are lots of variations on some of these. As I have said, the first thing is to be honest with yourself. You can never have an impact on society if you have not changed yourself. Great peacemakers are all people of integrity, of honesty, but humility. So we agree to look honestly at ourselves. We agree to pay attention moment to moment with our patterns to see what we're strengthening. And then we come to verse 27 when he takes an honest look at what that's like. What is it like to be enmeshed in your own craziness? I am as if benumbed by sorcery, my mind reduced to total impotence, with no perception of the madness overwhelming me. Oh, what is it that has me in its grip? Isn't that great? An intense craving arises. You're in meditation, and you go down and get into the refrigerator. I am benumbed by sorcery. My mind reduced to total impotence. We know if we look carefully at our own history, you know, that as we've been studying the Dharma, things become clearer and clearer to us. And we know there have been times in our life where we have acted so totally unaware that that sense, no perception of the madness overwhelming. You know, there's been a sense of, you know, before we became trained, you know, there'd be the sense of getting tremendously angry and thinking that it was clearly somebody else's fault. You know, we're totally unaware that it's our madness overwhelming us. We think we're justified. We think it's righteous. There's no sense that when we become enraged, we lack the wisdom to help ourselves or others. So we have experienced our neurosis as totally overwhelming us. So here's where Pema Chodron and her studies with Zigger Khantrol Rinpoche, she's a great communicator. So she says, watch that first instance of tightening before you even know there's something going on, before there's something you're angry about or something you're craving or whatever. There's a restlessness that's part of our mind in samsara, but then there is a small tightening. And then we leap into some irritation, and then we consciously inflame that irritation. We're right, it's their fault, clearly they're in the wrong, that not only should I be starting a protest, but I'm going to get on the phone and call on my friends to come protest, right? So it's a natural escalation of a neurosis. It doesn't mean you're not working for people's benefit, it means the kind of quality of mind that you're holding. Nelson Mandela, as he was leaving prison, was saying, if I leave prison with hatred in my heart, then I'm still imprisoned by my jailers. It's the quality of mind. It's not that the situation was not unjust, but it's the quality of his mind as he's working with the injustice. Verse 28, anger, lust, these enemies of mine are limbless and devoid of faculties. They have no bravery, no cleverness. How then have they reduced me to such slavery? So this is the big question. Our anger is not smart. It doesn't have its own intelligence. I'm going to seduce you today and I'm going to keep you angry. How is it that we are enslaved by these strong emotions, these poisons, the particular poisons? One of the easiest examples of how trapped we are, and it can be hysterically funny, is to think about an old relationship, a betrayal or something. And even from long ago, just thinking of it, you can start to feel upset again, right? And it's no longer present. You may even like the person, but it's the emotion that has you enslaved. I was in retreat for several months last year, and I was feeling really, really peaceful. So I thought I would test myself. And I gave myself, you know, what if I came out of meditation, came out of retreat, and then imagine a scenario where the person who gives me the hardest time is now in charge of my life, in, you know, in some sort of way. And I was upset for 2 days. And it was, totally imaginary. Just totally imaginary. The things we create in our minds enslave us, right? Just totally. Yeah, really. Okay, so now imagine your boss, you know, it's really, oh, okay, so I think it's really funny. Now verse 29, and this is really key. It is I who welcome them into my heart. I've made up the whole scenario, allowing them to harm me at their pleasure. I who suffer without resentment, thus my abject patience all displace. The key there is, it's I who welcome them into my heart. So one of the things that Pema was saying in this verse that was such an eye-opener to me is there's something in the kleshas that we actually love. We think we're getting something from them, which is why we welcome them into our hearts. And I think, you know, in some ways, in addiction, some of that is fairly clear. But the thought of when we are feeling empowered by righteousness, there can be an illusion of strength or an illusion of empowerment that righteousness about anything means you're heading into a grasping, self-absorbed kind of state. So it's not the wisdom of seeing the situation and finding the clear, skillful means. Righteousness has to do with I'm right and anyone who doesn't think this way is clearly wrong. He's inviting us to look at our particular neuroses, our particular kleshas, and ask ourselves, why do we welcome that into our hearts? What is it that we're getting from it that will help us sort of tease out in the knot why we find it so difficult to overcome? And then we can apply through analytic meditation the skillful means to overcome that. And then he's giving himself a pep talk again as to why he lets that happen over and over again. And now I'm at verse 32. No other enemy indeed has lived so long as my defiled emotions. Oh, my enemy, afflictive passion, endless and beginningless companion. So we can think of the rage we had as a child and the rage we had as a teenager. The cast of characters is different, but the emotion is the same. So it's the rage that's been the endless, beginningless companion, and it's the rage we want to dissolve. Therefore, now I'm 34, if these long-lived ancient enemies of mine, the wellspring of only increasing woe, can find their lodging safe within my heart, what joy or peace in this world can be found? That's what we're asking ourselves. If their lodging is safe within my heart, will I ever have peace of mind and joyfulness? If I make a safe place in my heart, there's no hope for peace of mind. Then he goes into his pep talk again. Imagine James Earl Jones. No need to say I will not lose heart, regardless of the hardships of the fray. These natural foes, today I'll strive to crush. These enemies, the source of all my pain. It's just great. So it's this chapter I find really wonderful because it's like a conversation. He sees his fear arising, right? And then he figures out what's going on. He makes a resolve. And then he sees the fear arising again from a different doorway. He figures it out and he makes a resolve. So you can see a very human, vulnerable person sort of working with many, many aspects of his mind. Verse 41, when I've pledged to free from their affliction beings who abide in every region, stretching to the limits of the sky, this is what we said we aspire to do, I myself was subject to the same afflictions. Thus I did not have the measure of my strength. To speak like this was clearly insanity. More reason then for never drawing back, abandoning the fight against defiled confusion. This I love for many different reasons. The beginning of really honest seeing. You know, there's the sense of, I made this aspiration to benefit all sentient beings. And then we find out the beginning place is with our own heart and mind. And you go, oh my goodness, I can imagine a difficult scenario and be completely trapped again. You know, I'm mired in the same, absolutely the same emotions. It must have been nuts to say that I aspire to benefit all sentient beings. I can't help myself. But then he's saying, that's why I won't give up. And that is the incredible teaching of Buddhism, that you begin to do this work in order to benefit self and all sentient beings. You see that the only way to benefit others is if you clear up the confusion in your own mind. And in the clearing of confusion in your own mind, you get the tools and skills to benefit others. In our wonderful sanghas and dharma communities, there are always occasionally disagreements among people. And and the Lama was saying, when there were these folks who just absolutely could not agree and didn't look like they could ever agree, he'd go, oh, that's wonderful, dear. they're sobbing. It's wonderful, dear, because you have to know how other minds work. So maybe you don't know how to get along now, but you see how another mind works, even though it's foreign to you. And when you're enlightened, you'll be able to help that person. So there's that sense of learning through your own pain and suffering what is human and vulnerable so that you can help others. You see what a great pep talk this is? I'm going to go back to, thus I did not have the measure of my strength. To speak like this with clear insanity, more reason than for never drawing back, abandoning the fight against defiled confusion. Now imagine Nelson Mandela in his cell, not able to see friends and family. And this is a quote, "Your playing small does not serve the world. Who are you not to be great?" There he was, like Shantideva. And Shantideva, if you looked, I visited Nalanda, and they have tiny little monastic bedrooms. The way a little monastic bedroom looks and the way a cell looks is not all that different. And the actual life is not all that different. It's the perspective that you hold. So Nelson Mandela used his time to work through his heart. And then he says to all of us, who are you not to be great? You're having it easier. Who are you not to be great? This shall be my all-consuming passion. This is verse 43. Filled with rancor, I will rage my war. Though this emotion seems to be defiled, it halts defilement and shall not be spurned. So he's taking his endless and beginningless companion, the rage, and now he's applying it to the defiled emotions. I'm going to see you as the enemy, and I'm going to apply all my focus on conquering you. He was a prince, and he was trained in all the skills of fighting. So you can see him applying a lot of that imagery, and it's fun. And when you're reading it, really, truly imagine Shakespearean James Earl Jones saying, "I will not, and I shall." So then he gets to, you know, the key verse, and this verse is something that we will go over in almost all of the chapters, and the whole wisdom chapter is condensed in this verse, verse 47. So we're thinking about the emotions that give us so much trouble in our lives. One of the translations is they torture us, right? And yet defilements are not in the object, nor within the faculties, nor somewhere in between. And if not elsewhere, where is their abode? Whence they might wreak their havoc on the world. They are simple mirages, and so take heart. Banish all your fear and strive to know their nature. Why suffer needlessly the pangs of hell? So we're looking at the emotion. We're looking at the anger, the rage, the jealousy, whichever is your favorite one. Everybody has the one they do best. You're thinking of that and you're saying, okay, that feeling, it doesn't exist in the object. So if you imagine a person you might be angry with, if I imagine the chocolate cake that I want, the craving, it doesn't exist in the cake, right? The cake isn't a siren calling out a song, come and get me.
Sure.
The enemy, so-called enemy, the person that you might be upset with or you might be jealous of or, you know, overly passionate about, it doesn't exist in them, right? It's in your mind. The emotion, the anger, the rage, it's not in your eyesight. Your eye does not have the feeling craving. The I itself is neutral, right? We make decisions about what we crave and what we don't crave. You know, there are sweet things that we don't crave. You know, so it's mental. It's not in the taste, actually. It's not in the smell. It's not in the sense faculties. The anger that we feel towards someone, it doesn't exist in our actual eyesight. It's what we think when we see them, right? So what he's saying is, okay, the whole thing now is to recognize that is a fleeting mirage that you welcome into your heart or you don't welcome into your heart, that you fan the flames of or you don't, that you strengthen or you don't. It's a momentary mirage. Banish all your fear and strive to know their nature. Why suffer needlessly? Know their nature. Why suffer needlessly? If you start to see that anger is a mirage, it's one thought that arises and then dissolves just by itself, right? We know that from shamatha meditation. A thought arises. If you don't put your attention on it, it goes away by itself. You don't have to even ask it to go away. You just say, return to breathing, and it's not there anymore, right? It's only when we say, I like that thought, I'm feeling strengthened by that thought or comforted by that thought or some security in that thought, I want to think about it more. You see what's happening? By itself, it's a mirage that cannot last unless we energize it. And we have to look at what is the nature of why we are in a pattern of energizing it. And what are the helpful things that will help us deconstruct that pattern? It is as if I'm benumbed by sorcery, right? And that's why the quality of attentiveness, awareness, is so important. We want to be aware and attentive, not benumbed by sorcery. We want to see it when it arises. Sometimes it's only apparent to us when it's in full force. Sometimes it's apparent when it's medium. Sometimes we can see, oh my goodness, I'm starting to think of, you know, all the wrongs they ever did me. Until we get down to the core issue of why is this still triggering. And that becomes the rest of the book as we go through that, particularly the wisdom chapter. Then verse 48, this is how I should reflect and labor, taking up the precepts just set forth. What invalid in need of medicine ignored his doctor's words and gained his health? So we're saying, this is the medicine. If you want to get well, you've got to take the antibiotic. You can't pretend, right? Khandra Rinpoche was saying she thinks Westerners are really funny because we expect enlightenment overnight. And she says, it's as though you're sitting there thinking that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are going to appear and say, but you, my dear, are the only exception. You don't have to work hard. Overnight, you can have this wisdom. We're looking at what the fox does, taking one step at a time, not making a giant leap that we are not ready for. What are the steps we can do, and how do we strengthen those steps and make those steps our pattern? So I'm going to start a little bit into the next chapter, particularly because I think some of the verses reflect Nelson Mandela so perfectly. And I'm going to verse 12 and 13. And again, to think of the incredible situation he was in with all his dear, his loved, beloved, all the beings that looked like him, facing such horrible things at a daily level, such terrible injustices. And here he was, we imagine him in the prison, using all his wisdom to understand and emerging from that prison, emerging from the sort of like the chrysalis of his life into this great bodhisattva. And these are key. The hostile multitudes are vast as space. What chance is there they all should be subdued? So thinking of the oppressors and his experience when it's a whole country that hates you. Let but this angry mind be overthrown, and every foe is then and there destroyed. The hostile multitudes are as vast as space. What chance is there that they all should be subdued? Even if all the bright people come to their senses, there's still going to be crazy people who are confused and still hate. Let but this angry mind be overthrown, and every foe is then and there destroyed. And then this beautiful example, to cover the earth with sheets of hide, where could such amounts of skin be found? But simply wrap some leather around your feet, and it is as though the whole earth had been covered. Likewise, we can never take and turn aside the outer course of things, but only seize and discipline the mind itself, and what is there remaining to be curbed? He was emerging, knowing that there would be all kinds of projections of hatred, that there was a change in terms of tremendous support, but the idea that every person would then be open to him is not possible. Even the Dalai Lama has people who hate him. So the only thing is to change one's mind. You can't prevent yourself from people arising, situations arising that are painful. The only thing you can do is transform your mind. So when the difficult situations arise, you have the wisdom to be aware moment to moment and make a choice about, in this moment, what pattern am I going to strengthen? That's why I like to imagine when he came out of prison, he could see a way of taking leadership and making the former enemies become allies so they would become in partnership working together. If he had come out with hatred, it wouldn't have been the same story. So I'm just going to read these again because these are three just extraordinary teachings. The hostile multitudes are as vast as space. What chance is there they all should be subdued? But let this angry mind be overthrown, and every foe is then and there destroyed. When the angry mind is overthrown, there is no foe anymore. It is a confused being that you aspire to help. To cover the earth with sheets of hide, to prevent pain, if we thought we could make the whole, our every step comfortable, there would never be enough cotton or leather anywhere to do that. But simply wrap some leather around your feet, and it is as if the whole earth had been covered. Likewise, we can never take and turn aside the outer course of things, but only seize and discipline the mind itself, and what is there remaining to be curbed. So we know the bright light of Nelson Mandela will forever inspire the world. So he is still with us in his demonstration of bodhicitta, still inspiring all of us with the questions of who are you not to be great? Who are you not to take up the bodhisattva intention and the bodhisattva vow? Can you imagine James Earl Jones reading the dramatic parts? So think of it as the inner workings of a friend who's doing Shakespearean drama. Really, do not read it with, oh my goodness, I'm going to go to, you know, clearly go to states of hell if I don't do this. No, he's giving himself courage by saying, okay, every action, I'm strengthening something. You know, which am I going to do? And how am I going to use all of my strength to go the direction that I want to go? So now we have time for questions. And that's a question for many, many people. The question is, we're in a situation of taking care of someone, and how much care? What is discriminating wisdom in these situations? A lot of this actually comes up in the next chapter that we're going into. You know, one of the early verses is, I've made a commitment. Is it a wise commitment? And there's also the sense of, the example is given, if two people are caught in quicksand, one person has to get out of the quicksand in order to help the other person. So attention will help you see moment to moment what's going on in your mind. So when you're interacting with the person that you're caring for, and I know lots of people are asking this question, are you maintaining bodhicitta and strengthening bodhicitta, or is the situation more than you can handle right now? So that's one thing. And then as our wisdom increases, when we're able to see what is actually helpful for the person that we're caring for and discriminate that better in terms of what is really needed by that particular person. There's an old story of the great Korean master and someone walking with the great Korean master, and you know, they're taking a walk and somebody comes and asks him for money, and he reaches in his pocket and gives him a big bunch of money. Later in the walk, somebody comes and asks him for money, and he looks at them and he goes, go get a job. You know, there's a sense of being able to see in the situation what actually is the medicine that's needed. But I know many, many people, you know, everybody who's a parent has that same question as well. The first part is just seeing what's going on in your own mind. And one of the refrains that we'll come to in the next chapter is, when you can't act in the moment and you don't know what to do, then remain as a log. Don't strengthen the wrong pattern. So that gives you time to sit with it and see more deeply what is actually needed in that situation. None of it is easy to do. But what we can see is, like, just from Pema's simple question that she asks us to look at, are we heading towards security or fearlessness? And one of the things they say about idiot compassion is, if you're being compassionate out of fear, that's not compassion. You know, it's the awareness, by having your mind moment to moment aware of the cycle of thoughts going through your mind, it can give you the space to ask the question, what is my intention? To make a choice in the moment instead of being caught up by any one of the emotions or any one of the patterns that we have. Hello, we have a question on the phone?
Yep, you do. Hi, Kendall. It's Janet from Michigan today.
Hi.
It's not really a question so much as a comment, but I'll be interested in your reflection on it. I read this chapter and listened to you today, and your talk, as always, was just marvelously illuminating and helpful and encouraging in terms of the material. But part of my attention has been on what we now know about neuroscience. And so the language in these texts is so much, and in how we speak about it often ourselves, is so much about the mind and only the mind, with the potential. I know that when we touch body, heart and mind, you know, I know the mind is located in the body, but I think that most of us don't actually work with that awareness much yet. And yet, I think neuroscience really tells us that. So, in a sense, when we talk about, you know, it's not in the places themselves, it's in what we do with it, what we make of it. There is a way in which it is in the places, meaning certain things, you know, do grab you. I mean, when people love their anger, you know, it's in response, in part, this is just potentially, in response to sort of that surge of adrenaline, which, you know, which people can get addicted to. And so the only reason I'm raising this is because, to me, it reinforces the importance of the yogas that go with the teachings. Because it is not just our understanding, but it is also what we learn to do energetically, which has, you know, gives us the neurochemical antidote to what these thoughts trigger that we become so attached to. Do you know what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying, and you have more experience in this area, but let me repeat it for folks. So Janet was talking about neuroscience. She was talking about why, you know, that certainly we can see that the thoughts are a mirage, but there is also a chemical response in the body.
So in response to the chemical response, I'm not saying this is a reason to give ourselves an excuse.
Right.
I'm just saying this is another thing we have to be aware of.
Right.
And for me, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just want to, I'm sitting here quiet and there's...
Right, of course, a lot of people listening. Yep, sorry.
So there's a chemical response in the body, and we might like the chemical surge. And something about the chemical surge also can grip us. And so we have to be aware of the instant response of the body. And Jen is also saying that's why she likes the yogas that go with the training, is mental and physical. you know, over time, the different kinds of training. And we still have a lot to learn about how scientifically our neural pathways are changing due to the meditation and the body's peace in that. Is that a good explanation, Janet? So this is not to in any way either give an excuse for, or Janet particularly is encouraging us not to ignore our bodies. And our bodies, I think you're also saying our body's capacity to help us. So particularly here, you know, in the meditation system, in the Tibetan meditation system, there's intense yoga that happens at a more advanced level. And we do have the dance forms that Venerable Dahani is teaching, and we have a whole Buddhist series of dances as well, or a framework in that mandala. Particularly for the verse that says, it is as if I'm benumbed by sorcery. And one of the incredible teachings from Pema Chodron in recognizing that feeling of being trapped and being benumbed is to do something different in that moment. You feel benumbed. You can, before you energize the pattern that you've always done, and then particularly I have found something physical is a great change of that pattern, like running out the door for a walk, going to circumambulate the stupa. It doesn't matter what you do so long as it's different. As soon as it's different, it breaks the pattern. Yes, thank you. That was an excellent comment, Janet. Are there any other folks in the queue for questions? Okay, any other questions here? So what Carrie was saying, and Janet doing incredible work in this area, is when the pattern is arising, if you can, and people would be at different abilities to see when the pattern is arising, is to see where is it in your body. Carrie was saying, particularly when you get to the point of being able to see the subtle shift, that little tightening, again, to identify where is it in your body and see if you can apply a physical antidote. So I think, you know, it's a couple thousand years since Shantideva was working in his little cell. And so the human mind hasn't changed, but all the wealth of information that we can do apply to it. So Janet is doing extraordinary work with soldiers and inviting them to yawn because they can immediately change a pattern or see that a pattern is arising and interrupt it with a yawn. Something as simple as that has a profound, profound effect. Okay, we have another question on the phone.
Yes, this is Ann Lucas near Boston. And I don't know if this is kind of a question, maybe it's kind of a comment too. When we're looking at these patterns that are the enemies that we're trying to defeat within ourselves, my go-to patterns are victim and martyr. Mm-hmm. And as those being my go-to patterns, I think what's happened over a long time is that I ignore my needs, I sacrifice to what I think is best for others, and violate myself. And so what I was hearing was, you know, you said, you know, Shariputra did too much and then ended up not trusting people and that set him back. And so what I liked about what you were saying was, for me, the place I am, I feel right now, is to sort of let it begin with me, in that I stop focusing on everybody else and how I can be taking care of them. And I begin to see how I need to take care of me so that I don't dig those ditches of being a victim and a martyr any deeper than I already have, because eventually that does become the resentment that you talked about that Shariputra had of, you know, well, I take care of everybody else, why does nobody even notice me, sort of thing. So I found this. I hope, you know, maybe you can clarify my thinking. But you know, the two qualities that leapt to mind for me are being a victim and a martyr, and willingly offering myself up as a victim, as a martyr, and allowing myself to be violated in various ways, thinking that I'm doing good.
Thank you. And I think that's, like the first question, something that many, many people share. So Anne on the phone was talking about something that you know, we might say we all have a piece in common with, when doing so much for others makes us feel like a victim or a martyr. You know, it used to be, they said that it was, in our culture, women grow up with that feeling. And I don't want to say that men don't grow up with it. You know, I'm sure that we all as human beings grow up with it. So particularly when we have the aspiration to do so much for others. So again, it's, we look at the first verse, what have I committed to? Can I do it joyfully? Can I do it strengthening my bodhicitta and others as I do it? Or am I confused? Do I need to straighten out my confusion? Am I helping in this situation? Or am I in a confused state, so I'm actually not helping, you know, or the martyrdom state, or, you know, one of those patterns. And then looking at that and seeing, okay, this is interesting. And it reminds me, actually, we're thinking a lot of Kenshin today as well, Kenshin Kunshin Gyaltsik, when he was saying that we have everything reversed, we have everything mixed up. We think that doing something for others is being selfless, and we think that understanding our own minds and clarifying our own minds is somehow selfish, like when we go into retreat. But in doing things for others, we're actually doing it so imperfectly that we're getting some merit for ourselves. Some people are helped and some people are not helped, depending on how imperfect we are doing the helping. Like we think of all of the good-hearted people who went out as missionaries and ruined civilizations. They thought they were helping. They were living really hard lives and they thought they were helping. Then he said, when you clarify your own mind, that's getting out of the quicksand so you can help others. That's actually benefiting people because you have clearer seeing and more skillful means. Then you know what's beneficial and you can actually benefit people. So we have to work with our own confusions and sort things out in a very sensible way. And this is one reason why I love Shanti Deva so much, because you see him sorting himself out. I pledge to help all these beings, but I'm mired in the same emotions. That's crazy. I have to figure out the emotions, figure out the craziness of my mind in order to actually help people.
Thank you.
He's so fresh in terms of his actual human voice coming through. You know, of a person just like us who, you know, as I was saying the first day, you can see him in his room at the monastery with everybody thinking he was useless because he was straightening the clarity of his ability to see moment to moment until he became enlightened. So interesting. So thank you, everybody. Again, he is a treasure. Our next retreat is the 29th, so it's a good way to think about your New Year's resolution for mindfulness, increased mindfulness. And then for those folks who wish, we'll have a retreat following the talk on the 29th into the New Year. And we might be able to do something for online participation for that as well. I know there have been successful retreats where people stay and retreat in their homes. So if folks are interested, they can write us about that. And there'll be a retreat here doing shamatha and mindfulness meditation. And then as people are thinking about the future, Venerable Dahani really encouraged me to keep publicly suggesting that we have residencies here. So you can come in, stay for a week, or people can come for temporary ordination for a few months, where you can use the time to look at the nature of your mind, to look at the step-by-step mindfulness. So I'm thrilled that everybody is sharing the wisdom and humor of Shanti Deva, and I look forward to the next talk. Thank you all. Bodhicitta, the excellent and precious mind, where it is unborn, may it arise. Where it is born, may it not decline, but ever increase higher and higher.